the fighting is raging on in the Ukrainian city of Soledar.
And this is, of course, not only confirmed by soldiers themselves, but also by Ukrainian officials that, unfortunately, the losses there are huge.
Plus, a change in leadership for Russia's military. But what does it mean?
If Putin is sending his best strategists to command the troops on the ground, it means that he's quite desperate.
And later in the program, Human Rights Watch has released its annual report, and our conversation with a former ambassador in the region continues. Today's Thursday, January 12th. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. The city of Soledar is seeing some of the fiercest fighting of the war so far. The AP's Karen Chamas brings us this update.
In one of the bloodiest battles of Russia's invasion, the fate of the eastern Ukrainian town of Soledar hangs in the balance. Russian forces used jets, mortars and rockets to bombard Soledar in an unrelenting assault. If Soledar were to fall into Russian hands, it would be a prize for a Kremlin starved of good battlefield news in recent months. It would also offer Russian troops a springboard to conquer other areas of Donetsk province that remain under Ukrainian control, such as the nearby strategic city of Bakhmut.
Postrel!
In the trenches in the Donetsk region, Ukrainian troops fire mortars at Russian forces. A Ukrainian soldier known as Fester tells the AP the Russian military fires relentlessly, sometimes just for practice. He said, "They don't shoot like we do. We count and clearly try to work well." I'm Karen Chamas.
Ukrainian authorities still maintain that Russian forces have not completely taken control of Soledar, but they do acknowledge the fighting is difficult and the costs are high. Russia is building up its forces in Ukraine, but Ukrainian forces are holding on amid fierce fighting. This according to Deputy Defense Minister Hanna Malyar. On Thursday, she told a news briefing that the number of Russian military units in Ukraine has risen to 280 from 250 a week earlier, as Moscow tried to gain the strategic initiative. She said Russia is driving its own people to the slaughter by the thousands, but we are holding on. She continued.
Fighting is fierce in the Soledar direction near Bakhmut. Despite difficult situation, Ukrainian soldiers are desperately fighting. Trying to break through our defense lines without any luck, though, and to capture Soledar, the enemy has high losses. The area outside the city is covered with the bodies of Putin's troops. Nevertheless, they, the Russians, are moving over their own corpses.
On Wednesday, President Volodymyr Zelensky said that Russian claims of victory in Soledar are propaganda. What's in the annual report from Human Rights Watch? We'll find out soon. Now, though, Russia ordered its top general on Wednesday to take charge of its faltering invasion of Ukraine in the biggest shakeup yet of its malfunctioning military command structure after months of battlefield setbacks. Reuters' Olivia Zelino has the details.
Russia shook up its top leadership in charge of its faltering invasion of Ukraine on Wednesday after months of battlefield setbacks. According to Russia's defense ministry, Chief of the General Staff Valery Gerasimov will take over as top commander. The move makes Gerasimov directly accountable for what Russia calls its special military operation in Ukraine. It's a demotion for General Sergei Serovikin, who's nicknamed General Armageddon by the Russian media for his reputed ruthlessness. He was in the job for just a few months. In a statement by the Defense Ministry, they said the reshuffle was meant to improve contacts between different military branches and the quality and effectiveness of the command structure. It all comes as Russian and Ukrainian forces engage in intense fighting over the eastern Ukrainian mining town of Soledar. Russia's private military firm Wagner said they had captured the town. But in a video address released moments earlier, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky denounced any claims that Soledar had been taken.
Now the terrorist state and its propagandists are trying to pretend that some part of our city of Soledar, almost completely destroyed by the occupiers, is some kind of Russian achievement.
Zelensky said the fighting continues and that they will strengthen Ukraine's defenses.
Reuters' Olivia Zelino reporting. Ukraine's ambassador to the UK said the recent change in military command in Russia shows that Russian President Vladimir Putin is desperate. In an interview with the British broadcaster Sky, Vadim Pristakyo said Putin is running out of options.
I believe that's the last step. The next one, the Putin himself, will have to command his troops because that's the success they're showing. And I understand that this the last change. Now, how can he explain that this allegedly second biggest army fighting with the Ukrainians who they lost and were talking that they will take over the Kyiv in 2 days and all of this stuff? Now he begging for ceasefire. He is appointing his top leader, military leader in command of operation, which he called limited military operations, not even a war.
Even as he calls Putin desperate, he acknowledges the fight ahead will not be easy and that the new commander has a formidable reputation.
He is an impressive military commander. I don't believe that he was commanding troops for decades. He is a good strategist. If Putin is sending his best strategist to command the troops on the ground, it means that he is quite desperate. We are not dismissive. We understand the danger of Russian army. We understand the danger of this hundreds of thousands of people being mobilized. It's not like, you know, we'll deal with all of them. We understand if they will have another mobilization, it will be very difficult to deal with them. So we are careful, but at the same time, we're quite optimistic. They are throwing everything they have, the last pieces, just to secure the victory, which we won't allow them.
That's Ukraine's ambassador to the UK, Vadim Pristakyo, in London on Thursday. And speaking of ambassadors, we'll continue our conversation in a few minutes with a former U.S. ambassador about ways this war might end. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. The past year has seen several human rights crises around the world, from Ukraine to China to Afghanistan, says Human Rights Watch in its latest annual report. It was released on Thursday. However, the authors also say that new champions of human rights have emerged. Henry Ridgewell reports.
The Human Rights Watch organization says that following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the global community deserves credit for unleashing what it calls the full arsenal of the human rights system, including an investigation by the International Criminal Court. Tirana Hassan is the acting executive director of Human Rights Watch.
We saw immediate responses from the international community to mobilize around key human rights supports, including establishing international justice mechanisms, evidence gathering for war crimes.
In towns like Bucha and Izium, there is widespread evidence that occupying Russian soldiers tortured, raped, and executed civilians. The United Nations Human Rights Council has documented several hundred civilian killings, thought to be a fraction of the total. Volker Türk, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, spoke to reporters in December.
In some cases, Russian soldiers executed civilians in makeshift places of detention. Others were summarily executed on the spot, following security checks in their houses, yards, and doorways.
Human Rights Watch's annual report also highlights ongoing abuses in China, including the mass detention, torture, and forced labor of as many as a million Muslims in the Xinjiang region. Beijing denies the accusations. The report says the UN Human Rights Council's increased scrutiny of Beijing's actions is encouraging. Again, Acting Executive Director Tirana Hassan.
What we have seen for the first time in a very long time is cracks in the authoritarian armor.
In Iran, protests triggered by the death of Mahsa Amini after she was detained by morality police have grown into nationwide anti-government demonstrations. Human Rights Watch says the execution of at least four protesters must trigger a stronger global response. Again, Tirana Hassan.
We need to move beyond international solidarity for protesters and need to make sure that governments all over the world are holding Iranian officials to account.
The report cites increasing human rights abuses in Myanmar, where the authors say the regime is launching assaults on communities across the country that oppose the military coup. In Ethiopia, Human Rights Watch says the recent African Union-led peace process has resulted in a fragile truce. Again, Tirana Hassan.
Ensuring that there is accountability for the egregious crimes that took place in the Tigray region, for example, is going to be critical for this ceasefire and this truce to actually hold.
The report says climate change is having an increasing impact on basic rights worldwide. It says governments have a legal and moral obligation to regulate industries such as fossil fuel extraction that are incompatible with protecting basic rights. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
As news of the devastation in Soledar continues to shock the world, I speak with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv for an update.
So President Zelensky today had his another meeting with all the top military heads, and he confirmed that the city of Soledar and the city of Bakhmut are the hottest spots and most difficult spots at the front line at the moment. And he confirmed that Ukrainian soldiers located there receive all needed equipment and all needed additional weapons in order to keep this area under Ukrainian control. And he also confirmed that everything is done extremely fast, as fast as possible. And this is a priority area at the moment. And we are also hearing from the recent reports from there that actually the fighting is ongoing, and again, it's really difficult to say what percentage of the city of Soledar is under Ukrainian control and what percentage is under Russian control. What is for sure that Russian forces do not control the city of Soledar, and the fightings are ongoing.
So Ukrainian Deputy Defense Minister Hanna Maliar, she said that Russians are being slaughtered by the thousands and that Russians are stepping over their own corpses in Soledar. Clearly a horrific image. Any sense from the Ukrainian authorities on what Ukrainian casualties are?
We don't have numbers. We don't have any direct confirmation that there are like thousands of victims, for instance. But what we are hearing, and this is, of course, not only confirmed by soldiers themselves, but also by Ukrainian officials, that unfortunately the losses there are huge. But again, for the moment, we don't have numbers, even a clue. I don't really think that Ukrainian officials would go get out to the society with numbers, at least before the war is over. But everyone understands that, the losses there at this point of time are huge. And this is also confirmed by the soldiers who are located there.
It was announced that in Russia, the top military commander in charge of the forces in Ukraine has been changed. Any reaction to that from Ukrainian officials?
This was announced yesterday, and it was a reaction. The general staff of Ukraine said that these changes show that Russian forces have problems in this war with Ukraine, and they have problems in terms of management of the military forces. And this shows that Russian army, which was seen as the second army in the world, do not have this standards and qualities of the second army in the world. So Ukrainian general staff their reaction basically is, of course, positive, because for Ukraine is a sign that Russian forces and Russian army have a lot of problems. And of course, this, you know, people are changing too fast, and they're changing too many times already.
And we'll leave it there for today. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Ukraine's success on the battlefield and Russia's failures came as a surprise to many, including my next guest. William Courtney is a former ambassador to Kazakhstan and Georgia. He negotiated Cold War-era treaties with the Soviet Union. We discussed his impressions of the Russian army and whether negotiations are possible. This is part two of our conversation. So given your experience, over the past 40 years or so, were you surprised to see how poorly Russia fared on the battlefield?
Yes. I didn't think that the best of the Russian forces, were involved right at the beginning. Their airborne troops, which are some of their best troops, for example, were involved right at the beginning, and the Ukrainians wiped out a large number of them. So I did not expect that Ukraine would do so well. And this was before a lot of Western aid came in. But the Ukrainians fought well with their former Soviet artillery, for example. It was mostly artillery rather than javelins that wiped out those invading forces that got stuck, the 40-mile group of armored vehicles that got stuck going down to Ukraine. So I think we were all pleasantly surprised. What we should have understood is the 8 years from 2014, the 8 years of training by NATO, U.S., other NATO allies of Ukrainian troops really worked out well. They learned the lessons. They fought a completely different way. The Soviets fought with a very hierarchical style where decisions had to be made at the top or senior levels. The Russians still fight that way. The Ukrainians learn to fight the way NATO does, in a more decentralized, agile, connected way, and they did very well. So we were pleasantly surprised, but I think all the way around, we were surprised how poorly the best trained Russian forces fought.
I know hindsight is 20/20. You negotiated with the Soviets on behalf of the U.S. If you knew then what you know now about their army being ill-equipped and poorly managed and ill-prepared, would you have done things differently?
So this came up in one specific context. We had negotiations during part of the Cold War called Mutual Balanced Force Reductions, MBFR. And that evolved later into the Conventional Force Reductions, or the CFE Treaty, Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty. Those took place in Vienna. The Soviets told us in the MBFR talks that they didn't really man all their divisions. They had a lot of divisions, but they didn't man them all at full strength. And in the West, we were a bit suspicious about that. But it turned out that the Soviets were more or less correct. The manning was uneven. They had a Category 1, which is fully manned, and Category 2, less so, and Category 3, even less than that. So there were some signs then that capability might be less than what it appeared to be on paper. But we negotiated a pretty successful, very good treaty in the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty at the time. So I'm not sure that we would have done it. I don't think we would have made more concessions, if you will, if we had known that the morale problems, leadership problems were as serious as they are now. Because we had to get that treaty through parliaments in Europe and through Congress in the United States, or through the Senate. So I'm not sure we would have done much differently. Now, the talks I was in was the nuclear talks. Those were in Geneva. And, we watched Soviet missile tests, things like that. So there was no question that they had capable nuclear forces. We never had that issue on our side because we saw them test their rockets, and they were pretty reliable. It was really the conventional forces where this issue has come up.
So you're a negotiator, an ambassador, a diplomat. Is there a deal that you can think of that can end this war?
No. Certainly not now. No, I think there are multiple ways this war could end. One could be regime change in Moscow. The Kremlin's under more pressure now than it's ever been in Putin's rule. The Russian army could collapse in eastern Ukraine. And of course, that happened in World War I. The Tsar's army collapsed. We could see emergence of frozen conflict of one sort or another. For example, from 2014 to the start of the war in February, there was kind of a frozen conflict in the Donbass, but there was firing back and forth on both sides. Another type of frozen conflict is what was in Abkhazia, still is Abkhazia and Transnistria, where it's frozen, but those sides are not firing. It's just pretty much peaceful. Another kind of frozen conflict, if you will, is what we have in Korea, where there's like a line of contact, if you will. Both sides are heavily armed on each side of the line of contact. They're not firing at each other, but it's high risk because you have heavy concentrations of mobilized troops on both sides and an armistice without any kind of peace agreement. So there are a bunch of different ways it could end. Lots of people think it's, you know, the West should prepare for a longer war. That's probably a prudent thing for the West to do, but preparing for a longer war should not cause us to predict that the war will be long. We just don't know. Our ability to predict is just as good as General Milley's at the beginning of the war when he said the Russians might be surrounding Kiev in 72 hours. So we should just follow Yogi Berra's advice about making predictions.
William Courtney is an adjunct senior fellow at the nonprofit RAND Corporation. He served as ambassador to Kazakhstan and Georgia. He was special assistant to the president for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia, and deputy negotiator in U.S.-Soviet defense and space talks. One of the biggest challenges for Ukrainian refugees who end up in the U.S. is finding a job. But one Ukrainian business in Philadelphia is doing what it can to help. Arina Solomko has the story, narrated for us by Anna Rice.
Olga Tkachenko is from Pokrovsk in Ukraine's Donetsk region. She is a teacher by training and 3 years ago opened a kids' development studio in Ukraine. But Russia's invasion of Ukraine left her with nothing.
When we got on a train to leave, a bomb fell right behind us, and I thought it was a sign. I took my kid and left in time. It took us some 30 hours to get to Lviv. Air raid sirens were blaring nonstop.
Together with her son, Tkachenko came to the U.S. and headed to Philadelphia, where she has relatives who were happy to accommodate her.
Right after we arrived, I started looking for a job because I was running out of money and we needed to live somehow. I called places, but I don't speak English, though I'm learning. And everyone asked about my English skills, heard I have none, and said no. But then I met Vera.
Vera Lyakh is co-owner of a Ukrainian grocery store chain near Philadelphia. Lyakh has been in the U.S. for over 16 years, but still, the war hit her hard.
I couldn't handle it. I didn't show up at work for over 2 weeks. I didn't want anything, only go to Ukraine and help. But I realized it's impossible. I couldn't leave people without work, so I knew I had to be strong.
In March, more Ukrainian refugees came to her for help, so Lyakh opened a new store in November. Now, she says, 25 Ukrainian refugees are employed at her two stores. Lyakh says this is how she can help, and she'll keep hiring Ukrainians as long as she can. For Irina Solomko in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.